Okay, good evening. Post-Purim itis, I think. I'm certainly seeing it with the students. They seem to be very finding it very difficult to come to after the celebrations of Purim, but I hope everybody had a good time. excuse me, we're on chapter 9, Perek Tesha, and we are really just going to... We're looking to get towards the end of the Sefer. One of the... just one second. One of the... I'm confusing you. We're actually on chapter 10, but we got through chapter 9 last week with the chapter ending kind of at a cliffhanger. That's what I wanted to mention, that the end of chapter 9 was this this sense of this incredible speech that was going on, which we spoke about last week, in terms of Am Yisrael and the way that they were now being encouraged to, you know, rededicate their lives to God, etc., etc. what we had at the beginning of chapter 10, which I jumped into, I was a bit devious about it, but basically what happens is that after this incredible speech, there is a covenant, a brit, which is made, and in fact it's a written covenant. It's called Shtar Amana. That's the word, yeah, it's the beginning of chapter 10. And that's where we're going to be starting this week. So, I don't know what page it is in the blue book, Perek Yud. 193. It's chapter 10 in Sefer Nehemiah. And what we did last week is that we read through this incredible speech, and I tried to give some sort of indication of how inspiring it was. The sort of lesson in history. The idea of, you know, of trying to galvanize the Jewish people, which is what Nehemiah is really very good at. You know, he is someone who clearly understands that this is a momentous time in Jewish history. We're bringing Am Yisrael back to Eretz Israel. We are rededicating the temple. We're going to rededicate Yerushalayim. As you'll see, there's going to be a very important dedication of the walls of Jerusalem. So basically, what's going on here is that the first stage of this dedication is a commitment. Am Yisrael are being made to commit to the values, to the ideas which Nehemiah expressed in the and the Levium and everybody else who was speaking through Perek Tet, through chapter 9. And in chapter 10, as a kind of continuation, they agree to sign a document. In fact, the Mefarshim explained that there are actually two documents. One document has the signatures open. It's like the Declaration of Independence, that you have the signatures available. And the other document, which is known as the hidden document, apparently they used to have two versions of everything. I suppose you have to have a copy, but in those days a copy was a serious issue. You had to get someone to write it all out. The second document had the signatures behind, on the back of the document, and it was kind of hidden. There's a symbolism for this, obviously to keep a record, and at the same time, it seems to go back to Sefer Yirmiyahu. He brings this here, if you want to look it up, Jeremiah chapter 32, where there is this concept that the two types of documents, one is revealed, and one is hidden. I guess it's kind of a lesson maybe to me it's all about, you know, what we just spoke about last week on Purim, the idea that God reveals himself. God is a revealed entity and also a hidden entity. And, you know, we reflect that maybe in terms of the way that they wrote this specific document, reflecting their commitment to God. All right, and by having the signatures on one of the copies revealed and one of the copies hidden, maybe that in itself is saying that we recognize through our commitment, through this document, that we are ascribing to God both revealed in history, how God revealed himself, and the hidden quality of God, which is with us to this very day. I kind of see a theme over here. I mean, it could be a bit far-fetched, I don't know. But I just wanted to share that with you as a sort of continuation of what we said last week. And I also want to just point out that from here to the end of the Sefer, there is a tremendous amount of listing of names. The names of the people, number one, that are going to sign this document. It goes on here for 25, nearly 30 psukim, just listing the names. And in chapter 11, we're going to have a list of names of people who went to live Yerushalayim. They had to force, imagine, you had to force people to go live Yerushalayim. Okay, and it says that a tenth of the population was, I suppose I'm going to use the word encouraged, but it was a bit more than that. They were implored upon to go and live in Yerushalayim to make sure that there is a Jewish population in Yerushalayim. I mean, you know, when you think about Jerusalem today and how difficult it is remotely to buy anything in Yerushalayim, to get any sort of foothold in Yerushalayim, and you think once upon a time people had to be paid to go and live in Yerushalayim. It just is beyond belief. So again, there's another list of names. That's chapter 11. And then chapter 12 is also going to be another list of names. And you'll see that there's going to be recording essentially all the different families of the Levites, Levim, and the people who are involved with bringing back the priestly the avoda, what we call the avoda, the service of the temple. Again, listing upon listing upon listing. I just want to share this because it's a true story. And it happened to a very close relative of mine, who always married an American girl, and she always claimed that her father was a Cohen. She always claimed her father was a Cohen, and it turned out that because her father was a Cohen, she's a bus Cohen. They had their first child. They didn't do Pidyon HaBet, and this is a long time ago. This is like 25, nearly 30 years ago in Israel, and about 20 years ago, the father who wasn't really sure, was he a Cohen? He always assumed he was a Cohen, right? He sort of always took the first Aliyah. He was a sure guy, so he wasn't particularly, wasn't 100%. He was a traditional guy. But he did a trip to Poland. And his trip to Poland, part of the trip was to go and visit where his grandparents are buried. And he took pictures of the Matzeva and didn't quite twig that there's something missing in the wording in the Hebrew on the Matzeva, the word Cohen. It's missing. It's not there. And in fact, you'll see that when you have the Matzevas in from Poland, there's imagery on the Matzevas, which in fact usually describe who the person was. The Kohen would have the image of the fingers that they hold up when they duchen. That's right, when they sort of split the idea of the rays of Kedusha that they spread out. There's also somebody who died in childbirth. They always have the image of a broken candlestick. It's very interesting. And that was that. And you found out about the person that she died very young, usually in childbirth. And a lot of images, like there's a book about this, all the images on the tombstones. And the story with the relative is very simple, that he came back, showed his rabbi these wonderful photos, and the rabbi said, wait a minute, where's the word Cohen? And then it turns out, of course, that he's not a Cohen. All right, so my relative had to be redeemed, as it were. I think he was already 12 years old. They did not bring him in on a silver tray, I have to say, to his relief, because he was wondering how they're going to, bring him into the room. And they did a Pidyon HaBen at the age of 12. It's long overdue, but you found out that he wasn't a Kohen. So I'm telling the story because very often today, what translates from this is the wording, how careful we are when it comes to tombstones. That these are resources, and they tell us a lot about the life of the person, about where the person is coming from. There are names. My son-in-law made a wonderful announcement at his second son's bris, and he said that we're going to use names that we like, and we ran out of dead people to name after. That's what he announced. If you know my son-in-law, Chemi, then he can get away with making a comment like that. He said it in his British accent, everybody found it very amusing. I was mortified. But at the same time, I understand what he was saying. The reality of it is that, the Matzeva is really, really important to get the name right and to get the name recorded, etc. Like we put up boards in shuls. Keeping these names recorded is not just an extra, but it's actually really important for purposes of yichus, etc. In London, every marriage for the last 100 years is recorded at the Beth Din. If you want to find out where your great-grandmother got married, if she got married in England, they will pull out a piece of paper and show you the marriage license. Unbelievable. That is an incredible resource. And people come from all over the world to check if there was any sort of marriage in England. In this country, it's really not the same. And part of the deal with rabbis dealing with weddings is to find out who the people are in terms of their status, their Jewishness, and again, a lot of reliance, and I've known a lot of rabbis who do this, they rely on tombstones. If you bring a picture of your grandmother's tombstone to the rabbi and prove that you're Jewish, because your grandmother was Jewish and it's your mother's mother, that's enough for most rabbis to give you a status of being Jewish. And they will marry you in an Orthodox ceremony.
Does that satisfy the Israeli rabbi?
The Israeli rabbi, that I'm not sure. I can't speak for them. I don't know. My guess is maybe, but maybe not.
I don't know how to prove I'm Jewish.
Right. And that might be one of the ways. That's why taking pictures of going to Europe, if you can find Kever Ovis, if you have, you can go back that far, is always very, very useful. Very useful. So just wanted to say, you know, it reminds me of what we're talking about here, recording name after name after name, is something that we do, but we don't really think about it, but it is extremely important. One, and then Abe, I think, was...
Jewish genealogy.
Oh, there you go. You're the genealogy guy. I forgot.
Right. They found that it's not always accurate, the direction of what's the situation on the...
That's also a question mark.
Because it's supplied by the survivor, and the survivor has only a limited amount of information.
Correct. And they would have made mistakes,
and mistakes could be made.
Right,
so it's not necessarily approved.
But it's an indicator. It's certainly an indicator.
We learn you have to get corroboration, right?
Yeah. And many shuls had a pinkas, what they call pinkas, which was a book of names and a record of, you know, what we're talking about, marriages and deaths and whatever. And if you can get your hands on that. And there are some which are still, you know, sort of exist after hundreds of years. That will be the corroboration.
And a lot of it did survive World War II.
And it survived, yeah, miraculously, in many cases. They have these memorial books, and a lot of them are based on that information. So it's an interesting thing, yeah.
If I may, a very quick story about this issue.
Yeah.
From Herschel Schaffner's father.
Okay. Yeah.
So he goes to the Rav and says, I knew his grandfather, he's not a Kohen. So the Rav calls him in, they do an investigation. The Rav says, he's not a Kohen, give him Malkus. After they give him Malkus, the Rav says, Nachamol. Again, he says, why Nachamol? He says, Bim Kohen Levi.
Bim Kohen Levi. Oh, he's funny. Yeah, that's a true story. Hey, all right. It's a good one, though, I like it. It's very hard. This is a really tough thing. And what you mentioned about the Israeli rabbi is a good question. I don't know. If you ever get a hold of a chief rabbi, if they ever come, good question to ask. Proving Jewishness. It's very important. Normally they will accept documentation from Chutz La'aretz, but the question is what documentation? And it'll have to be sort of verified by a Beis Din, and usually that's what it was. It's complicated. All right, so again, I thought I'd mention that because, as I said, we've got such a lot of names. And we've probably been sort of trying to preserve these names ever since. Just to sort of keep the what they call in Hebrew, yichus, keep the genealogy, essentially, keep it going. So again, chapter 10, we sort of jumped into this. I'm just going to look at the first couple of verses, and then we're going to go to verse 29. It says like this, B'chol zot anachu kotim amana v'kotvim, v'yala chatum sarenu, levienu kohenenu, we have on the signing of the document that we are about to sign, as a commitment to everything that was said in chapter 9, we will have our princes, our Levim, and our Kohanim. And of course the question is, this seems to be the wrong order. The Kohanim always come first, followed by the Levim, followed by everybody else. So this is where the rabbis start digressing and saying that the Kohanim would be signed first on an open document. But here we're talking about the other type of document, which may have been put away, hidden, and on that document you would have a different order. The princes would become first, the leaders, followed by the Levim, and finally the Kohanim. All right, and the way it used to work is a bit like what they call get kerer. If you study Gittin, you know that they used to make a get, and to delay the process, they would fold the get over. Right, they would do folding, and they would get the witnesses to sign on every fold. It basically was a time thing. It delayed the process in case they would change their minds before the finishing writing the get. So one gets the impression that this might be a similar thing, and not having the signatures on the front of the document, and the signatures on the back of the document. And it just reminded me of that, and it's one of those ploys that they would have used in those days as well for keeping this particular document. As I said, there's a symbolism in having an open document and having what they called a closed document. You know, if you find something else on this, please let me know, because it is a bit strange. And Pasuk Bet, V'yala Chatumim, Who is going to sign this document? And we start off, Nehemiah, Tishata, because we're talking about the leaders, right? So you got Nehemiah, Ben Hakalia, and Tikiah, and then it goes on and on and on. So I'm going to go to verse 29, Pasuk Kaf Tet, because I'm not going to just read through all the names, you'll see. If you're really into comparing lists, there are lists over here in chapter 11, there's a list in Sefer Divrei Yamim. Also a similar list. We had lists back in Sefer Ezra. We've already had a list in Sefer Nehemiah. If you want to line them all up, there's a lot of repetition, and there are a lot of things which are missed out. The Malbim does try and sort of balance all the different lists, because he says in some cases certain names are missed out, and he tries to explain why. Now, it's sort of thing that, you know, I leave you to look at in your own time. You've got, if you're that organized, you want to make spreadsheets with all the names on it, then you can sort of make those comparisons. I think it's certainly not a bracha levatol. It's on the contrary, it's a good thing to do, but not within the context of what we're doing. It's just something to recommend. So we're going to go to verse 29, Kaftet. Now comes everybody else after all of these people have signed the choshuva mention, as they say. We've got now the rest of the priests, Levim, Shoarim, which seem to be like the gatekeepers, people in charge of the gates, presumably of Jerusalem, Ashoarim, Natinim were these converts that they had, going right back into the story of Yeshua. And those who are separated from the peoples coming to God, these are the Gerim. Rashi says this means the converts. They also were signed on this document, making their commitment, their new commitment to God and to the historical existence of the Jewish people, everything we spoke about last week. Nesheim, Beneim, Notem, Kol Yedem, Mevin, anyone who was old enough to understand would sign this document. Very interesting. And Pasuk Laman, Machzikim Alacheim, and they would, together with their brothers, Adirehem, and together with their nobles, Boim, Ba'olo Bishmo, they were prepared to make even an oath on this. Right? This is a real covenant. And they're swearing to abide by the commitment which we saw in the previous chapter, Lo Leche B'Torah Elokim, to go in the ways of the Torah, Asher Nidna B'Yad Moshe, Eved Elokim, which was given to Moshe, the servant of God, Lishmo Lasot Et Kol HaMitzvot, to do all the mitzvahs of God our Master, Mishpatav v'chukam. Very interesting. So this is again, it's almost like Nasa v'Nishma all over again. This is what's going on at the beginning of the Second Temple period. You got, and this is a very good question. The whole thing comes up in the next section, and we'll deal with that. All right, because we're going to say that although the majority of the Jewish people are not in Eretz Israel to make this covenant, but there is a very strong body of opinion which says that each tribe was represented. So you'll say to me, wait a minute, 10 tribes were exiled. So there is an interesting thing that not everybody agrees that of the 10 tribes that were exiled, they disappeared completely. There is this suggestion, a whole body of opinion, which says that Yirmiyahu managed to find representatives from each tribe and brought them back, or arranged that they would be able to come back to Eretz Israel. And therefore, what you've got here, even though you haven't got all of the people, obviously, but you've got representatives of Klal Yisrael. And by having that group coming together, they can make this promise in the name of the Jewish people. All right, and that's basically, I think, it's like what was done in 1948. 600,000 Jews living in the state of Israel, making this tremendous commitment on behalf of the Jewish people. Right, you know, it's that kind of wording. If you look at the Megillat Atzmaut, the Declaration of Independence, you'll see exactly what they said. And it's, again, a very similar idea. To me, it's like a modern version of what's going on here. If they thought about it at the time, I don't know. Knowing Ben-Gurion, he probably did. He was certainly a biblical scholar, no question about that. So again, Pasuk Lamed Aleph, and the commitment is specific over here. And again, I'm going to ask the question, why do they pick these specific mitzvot out of the whole 613 or whatever number you want to put on this? Why these specific mitzvot are focused in their commitment? And I've got a thought, but I'll share with you at the end. Just listen to this. Lamed Aleph. Asher lo nitein benotein lamein. Well, this one is obvious, because this is the thing that's bugging them. They made a commitment not to marry the local women, the non-Jews. Vet benotehem lo nikach lebenene, and not to take the daughters of the non-Jews for their sons. No intermarriage. Lamed bet. V'yamei ha'oretz ha'mivim et ha'makachot v'chol sheva b'yom ha'shabbat. A commitment to keep Shabbos. And we're going to actually deal with this, Mitzvah, I think our last year, in a few weeks' time, I want to deal with Nehemiah's incredible attention to the laws of Shabbat. There's a Gemara, the beginning of the Perek Kol HaKelim, if you want to look it up, Gemara Shabbat, around about page 122, 123, and you'll see there that it mentions Nehemiah ben Chakalia, how he managed to reinvigorate the Jewish world in terms of their relationship to Shabbat. And Shabbat was something that, you know, to us, I mean, I don't know, as you get older, you just appreciate it so much more. As a kid, it was always about the don'ts, all right? When you get older, it's much more about the do's. You know, what Shabbat represents in terms of time out, all right? No telephones for 25 hours. What a blessing that is. When you talk to non-Jews about that, they really don't get it. They can't believe that you can exist for 25 hours without an iPhone. How do you do that? The answer is that it's if you do it, you do it. So back to this. He says that what used to happen is that the non-Jewish merchants used to bring food to sell to the Jews on Shabbat. And he says, "V'chol sheva b'yom ha'Shabbat limkor lo nikach mehem b'Shabbat." We won't buy on Shabbos, we're not going to do any business. Ubayom Kodesh, and on the holy days, meaning obviously the holidays, or Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, meaning, and that's commitment number two, all right, essentially, although we call it commitment number three. First commitment to the mitzvah of the Torah, second examples. Number one example is not to intermarry. Number two example is not to profane the Shabbos. In terms of business. Example number three, Vinitosh et Hashana Shviit, Umasa Kol Yad, and we will observe Shemitah, which is sort of the derivation of Shabbos. But if you think about it, what's going on here is kind of interesting. The intermarriage, and yeah, I see this purely in terms of Benon Lechavera, Benon Lemokom. We're seeing here that in terms of the initial thing of not intermarrying, you can say this is between man and God, but essentially it is interpersonal relationships of the people surrounding you that you're saying, you know, we'll have to have dealings with you of some sort, but we're not going to marry you. And then he goes on to Shabbos, which has clearly been on Lamaka, right? We're making a commitment to Shabbos not to do business, which is, again, a commitment between man and God. And then, Chavera. And then the third concept of the Shemitah, and at the end of the Pasuk, Masa Kol Yad is talking about the release of debt, which is part of what Shemitah is a separate commitment. Which is in fact stressed over here is the commitment to Eretz Yisrael. Because in the end of the day, what's going to happen is that if they're going to be in Eretz Yisrael, they have to appreciate that there is an extra dimension of mitzvot. According to the Ramban, as famous Ramban at the end of Sefer Bamidbar, he says that we keep mitzvot in Chuslar. I don't want to make this too public, but he says we're doing it as a reminder of what we should be doing when we go to Eretz Yisrael. Right, a famous Ramban. He says, in fact, keeping mitzvot in Chutz La'aretz, he says, siyunim, it says this is a signpost, that when we go back to Eretz Yisrael, we'll know what to do when we're back there. All right, that's a kind of shocking thought, that everything that we're doing here, which looks as if we're observant, is all about preparing ourselves for being in Eretz Yisrael, where there the mitzvahs are to be performed in the, how should we say, l'chadchil, in the first best situation. And that is the Ramban's opinion as far as mitzvot outside Eretz Yisrael. Very, very interesting. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons they left. That's right. And there's a big deal about that. So that is clearly the commitment. All of these things, certainly the intermarriage is certainly playing on their mind. The Shemitah, you're absolutely right. And then Shabbos sort of thrown in the middle there, which again must have been an issue, but wasn't such an issue that it was talked about, but became, I guess, the... To me, it's also about mitzvahs which will inspire the people to connect, right? When I was just, I don't know, it came across my computer this week, one of the videos that was made on the Shabbos, that, you know, they do this now, this world Shabbos thing, Across America, but it's more than that. This is Shabbos across the world. It started in South Africa, and it's that the communities around the world are all going to observe Shabbos for 24 hours, 25 hours. Meaning not just to do a Friday night, which everybody likes doing, and the chicken soup and everything else, but to do a full Shabbos with a Havdalah at the end. And it started in South Africa. Rabbi Goldstein, who's the chief rabbi there, started it with the South African community, and it caught on fantastic success. And the first year was tried in South Africa. And then the chief rabbi in England took it on. Rabbis here have tried, but the American experience is very different. It's a different concept to South Africa, which has built into it, into the Jewish life, the ability to do this. Smaller scale, and you reach a lot more people. But it doesn't matter. The reality of it is that, you know, this idea that Shabbos can become inspirational. You see those Havdalah ceremonies around the world. They show, this video was showing it in Australia, was showing it in South Africa, was showing it in South America. You see people in tears. You see people crying. The Shabbos has gone away. It's like an NCSY event. You know, if you've ever been to those, you'll see the people, you know, the kids are crying at the end of Shabbos. And it's one of those incredible things. So Shabbos is clearly inspirational. And I think, again, I'm looking for themes over here, why he focuses on these specific mitzvot as part of the commitment. The idea of being inspired by the mitzvot as well as the basic commitment to them, but he's picking on things which hopefully will, you know, inspire the people to reconnect to God. And we're talking about a whole generation that is disconnected. It's unbelievable. And the comparisons to now are really very, very stark. Look at this, Lama Gimel. He says, "V'amano aleinu mitzvot l'teito aleinu shlishita shekel v'shana." This is very interesting. He says that we're going to keep a third of a shekel. Now everybody knows we're talking about half a shekel. All right. So the rabbi said, play around with the numbers. That the Persian shekel. A third of a Persian shekel. Let's say one shekel is, I don't know, it weighs, the shekel of the Bible weighs, let's put a number on it, I don't know, 10 ounces. So the half a shekel will be 5 ounces of silver, right? And here the Persian shekel, which is bigger than the Israeli shekel, if that's the way to describe it. And you've got to get that 5 ounces of silver. So if the Persian shekel is where it weighs 15 ounces, then a third of a shekel will be the same 5 ounces. So basically what's happening is that they're using a different measure, but coming out with the same chatzi shekel. Okay, and again, this chatzi shekel is something which is part of the commitment. Is it inspirational? It may very well be. What's the basic message of anything to do with halves? Is that half and half makes a whole. All right, so chatzi shekel, to have Jewish life can never be, you can never be a full Jew if you're living by yourself. Right, that's always one of the messages of Machzor Shekel. That to give a whole shekel, you've got to come onto somebody else. You've got to partner with another Jew. And the idea of Machzor Shekel is the idea of never being satisfied with just being on your own. A Jew on a desert island may be very happy with his three shawls or whatever he has over there, but the reality of it is, it's not going to be the same as living in a community with people, however difficult our Jewish brethren can be. The idea is a community is still a community. So again, I think that's an interesting message over here, but it's a third of a shekel which they are being encouraged to give, referring to Persian shekels. That's what some of the people say here. La'avodat beit Elokeinu, to serve God. Obviously donations. And now we're going to go through all of the preparation that they have to make donations to the temple. Lamadalat. Lelecha marechet, they're going to need bread. For the showbread, right? So how are they going to get that together? Minchata tamid, and they're going to have to do the mincha, which is a constant sacrifice. All of this money that they're raising is going to produce this. Ulolata tamid, and they're going to make an ola every day, a burnt offering. Hashabbatot, hachadashim, lemoadim, for all the holidays, Shabbos and Yom Tov, etc. Lekodshim, lechatos, and they're going to need the money for all the holy things that they're going to need. This could have presumably been, again, other types of sacrifices. Obviously, chataot are sin offerings. L'chaper Yisrael, to atone for the Jewish people. V'chol melech beit Elokeinu, all the money that they need, basically just to run the Beit HaMikdash, to run the temple. It's about, the donation is always about, you know, sort of really what the person puts into it. A famous story, and again, if you've heard this from me, I apologize, but it's a very, very beautiful story. That Reb Chaim Volozhin, and it was the Netziv, Rav Tolly Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, was the Rosh Hashiv in Volozhin. And they had a Mashulach who used to send him around the whole of Eastern Europe collecting money. And the guy every year would go to the same people, and he used to get donations from different people. It was very, You know, it was his route. He went around. And one year he goes to the Nasiv and he says, Rabbi, my clothes are a bit shmata now. I'm wearing the same clothes and the same horse, and the horse looks as if he's just about to die. I need an upgrade. So the rabbi said, you're right. And he gave him an upgrade, and he had a new suit, and he had a new horse, a new wagon, and he goes on his route the next year, and he comes to a certain person who opens the door and sees him, and recognizes him, and slams the door in his face. And the guy shouts to the door, Rabbi, don't you recognize me? He says, yeah, but I don't give money for horses, and I don't give money for clothes. So he went back to the Nasiv, he said, this is what happened to me. So the Nasiv says, listen, I'll come with you next time. Whoa. So he opened the door the next time, and standing there, instead of the Meshulah, was the Nasiv. Right? So, Rosh Hashiva, what are you doing here? And so he said, can I come in? So he sat down with this Jew, who used to give a good donation. And he said to Rabbi Yid, I realized last year you didn't give a donation. I want to learn something with you. Do you learn Gemara? No. Do you learn Mishnah? He said, no. He said, do you learn Chumash? Yes, I know Chumash. So he said, take out a Chumash. It's last week's, 2 weeks ago, the Parsha of Parshas Vayakel. And in Parshas Vayakel, it says there that what did Bezalel do? He formed all the different kelim. And it says, lachshov machshavon. He could think thoughts. What does that mean? Says in the Tziv to this Jew, he says, what does it mean that he lachshov machshavon? So the rabbis say he understood how to make these different kelim, and he was very artistic, whichever way you explain it. He says, no. He says, what it meant like this is very simple. He says that when Bezalel got a donation, he had such an insight that he knew what the person was intending with the donation. If a person gave $1, but he gave the Shem Shemayim, it went straight to the Kodshei Kodshim. If he gave $1,000, but he wanted his own name on a plaque, then it went for the upkeep of the Beit HaMikdash. Right? It made the floors, and it made the ceilings, and it would pay for the paint, and maybe, you know, sort of the tea outside, but it wouldn't be used for the Holy of Holies, because it wasn't given with that machshava, with that thought. And he said to him, Rabbi Yid, you should know that your donation doesn't go for the horses, doesn't go for the suit. It goes straight to the Beit Midrash, straight to the Bochrim, because that's what it's about. Because I know that when you give your money, you give it with a complete heart. And of course, he got the donation. That was obvious. But the vort is such a beautiful vort. And this is what it says over here, the same idea of making sure that when this money is given, what it's going to be used for, it's hopefully going to be given with such sincerity. Again, that's why I think it's inspirational. It's going to be given with sincerity. It's going to go for all of these incredible, rekindling of the menorah and all this stuff and the burnt offerings and everything else. This is going to be inspirational for the Jewish people. And this is what, again, I see a theme of inspiration. And Lamed Hey. Lamed Hey. Vagoralot ipalno al korban etzim. We even had to make. There was obviously a lot of people started getting involved in this, so we had to make a lottery for the korban etzim to decide about the wood for the offerings. They had to donate the wood to make the pyre that they could then burn the offering on. Hakohanim alaviim va'am lavi lebeit elokeinu, that they all divided up all these different groups to bring it to the temple, lebeit avoteinu, the house of our fathers, the itim mezumanim shana b'shana, certain times every year, and we know that the Mishnah talks about that there was a time when they would stop bringing the wood after the summer equinox, you know, the Tu B'Av thing. That was one of the things that is referred to. And it, what did they use of the wood? Levael amizbach Hashem, elokeinus would be burning on the altar. Kakatu Torah, everything is following the script. But again, he's picking on these mitzvot because I believe it's also the idea of people being involved, people sort of feeling part of what's going on. That is really crucial to this very day. The sense of community is not just about belonging to community, but feeling part of the community. Right? You know, you send your check, and that's very nice. There's a shul in London which doesn't get a minyan, but they've never been in debt ever. And I asked the rabbi there, how does it happen? And he says, we've got one member lives in the south of France. He pays our deficit every year. He sends a check. So I said, but what sort of member is he? He said, I have no idea. Never met the guy. But he's, you know, he feels because his family sort of, you know, grew up in this particular synagogue. He hasn't visited the shul in 25 years, but he sends that check every year. They don't have a problem. But is that a member of the shul? No. Not at all. You know, he's got no connection, except he pays the bill, which is an interesting thing, a concept. This shul, I'll never forget that, in central London. But I imagine there are shuls like that here as well. Yeah, Rosh Hashanah Kippur is different. I think there at least they're coming as part of that group for Rosh Hashanah Kippur. This guy never turned up ever. And it's a whole story. It's It's good to have a guy like that. It pays the deficit. That I thought was a good idea.
Rabbi,
yeah.
When I met the Bayou, a rabbi was leaving his community, was moving actually. The shul was closing. So he said to me that when the shul closes, we'll just move into a post office box because it keeps getting donations.
Yeah, the donations keep coming. Yeah, there are jokes about that, but I'm not going to go there. Lamed Vav. Now, here's another interesting mitzvah that he focuses to bring bikurei admatenu, bikurei kol peri eitz shana b'shana lebeit Hashem, to bring the bikurim. Now, again, the bikurim, I guess, is very motivational because, you know, it's the first and it's something which you make a procession. And the beautiful thing in Israel, even amongst the non-observant, the kids particularly, before Shavuot, are these very beautiful processions you see from the kindergartens or whatever with Bikurim. Bikurim is a big theme in Israel. Obviously, it's to do with the produce of the land, which everybody can relate to. It's something I remember seeing, you know, every year you used to see this. Lamed Zayin, Vet Bechorot B'neinu B'Behemteinu, and of course to do Pidyon HaBen. The firstborn, Kakatuba Torah, but Bechorei Bechoreinu Tzoneinu Lavi Beit HaLekeinu, firstly to bring the firstborn animals to the temple, L'Kohanim Mashatim Beit HaLekeinu, and then again, you know, sort of all the mitzvahs that are connected with that. And then, Ved Reshit Arisoteinu Trumoteinu, I was thinking about this, this Shabbos program that's going on at the moment, once a year, it's usually the Shabbos after, it's usually Parshas Noah, a lot of the women get involved through the challah baking. There's like, I mean, my daughter told me in Houston they did it this year, and 500 women came to bake challahs and didn't even know who they were. And I know in London they have to take over like a very big space in many, many communities just to accommodate the women who want to come and bake challah. All right, and again, this obviously is a reference to this, an inspirational mitzvah of providing the chalot or getting involved with the giving the dough and you know making all that preparation for the laws of challah is again something which he singles out. Yeah.
What they're saying here is every facet. This is their life.
Yeah.
They didn't have an industry. They had farming. They had baking.
Correct.
So every facet of their life is being dedicated.
And that's also that's an overall thing. But again, I want to just add this element of. Also, they're being inspired by all these things. You know, these are things which involves not a great commitment. You know, taking challah is not a big deal. Even bikurim, you know, at the end of the day, they're there. You know, you're not.
But it's the trivial as well as the grand.
Correct. It's not that you're giving a bigger donation. You're a holier person. On the contrary, it's not even about that. It's about the general joining in of being part of the. Process and this is very beautiful. And Lamelchet, Ved Reshit Arisoteinu Trumoteinu Pri Kol Eitz Tirosh Mitzar, the fruits of the trees of the wine and the oil. Navila Kohanim Elishchod, we will bring to the Kohanim to the offices of Beit Elokeinu. Umased Matenu Laviim, and we'll give the Maaser to the Laviim. Vehem Laviim and Maasrim B'chol Arei Avodateinu, and they also the Laviim. This is actually. Goes back to something that we learned to say for Ezra, that Ezra actually was not happy with the fact that Levim did not come back to Eretz Israel as part of the original group. And he made a knas. And therefore they didn't keep their tithes. Because look what it says next, Lamatet, V'haya Kohen ben Aaron, im alavim ba'sel Levim. That Levim had to share the tithes with the Kohenim. So normally they would keep the 10% of the tithe, but in this case Ezra had made a rule that in order to make a kind of a knas against a fine, they had to share their tithes. Which again was saying to them, you know, the fact you didn't come and do what we expected Levim to do, to come back to Eretz Israel, is reflected in this particular situation. And v'alevim ya'alu et maaseh ha'maaseh lebeit elokeinu, and the Levim would then bring this tithe of tithe, whatever it is, in other words, they would get whatever was set aside, they would bring it to the house of God, ela l'shchot lebeit otzar, to this place of store. V'ki et kol, ki ela l'shchot yoviu b'nei Yisrael, ubenei levi et trumata dagam v'tirosh v'yitzar, they bring all the truma into these particular places of the temple, v'sham kleh mikdash, that's where the holy vessels would be, v'kohanim v'mishotim, and the kohanim were serving, v'sharim, mishorarim, and all the various people that we mentioned before, lo nazov et beit elokeinu. This is again something which reminds me, there was a slogan, lo nazov et akota, during the war years between 1918 and 1939, there was this tremendous sense of being faithful to the Kotel. The British didn't like it. The Brits were very anti this, and they banned the Jews from blowing shofar. I think I mentioned it. After Yom Kippur, they made a big deal about it. And Davka, there'd be groups going to the Kotel, right? Not necessarily religious groups, but they'd be there Yom Kippur in order to defy the Brits and blow shofar after Yom Kippur. And again, it was, I think their slogan, if I'm not mistaken, Lo Na'azov. Lo Na'azov et HaKotel, really reflecting what he says here, Lo Na'azov et Beit Elokeinu, we will not forsake the temple of God. Fabulous stuff. I mean, this is again sort of just putting together the beginnings of the Second Temple. Of course, when you read the history of the Second Temple, it becomes very depressing because a lot of this did not last for very long, and you almost get the feeling that that's why the Bible stopped where it did, you know, not to tell us even about the Hanukkah story, which has its ups and very much has its downs, as you know from sort of, you know, just hearing about some of the fallout of the Hanukkah story, particularly in terms of Jewish leadership. So a lot of this is again very significant. I'm going to be very devious because we've got another 2 or 3 minutes, and I'm just going to talk very quickly about chapter 11 because again it's all names. So what happens in chapter 11? Beginning Pasuk Aleph, Yeshu Sarei Ha'am Yerushalayim, Ushah Ha'am Yipilu Goralot, Lavi Echad Min Asara L'Shem Yerushalayim. Yirat Kodesh. They drew lots that 10% of the Jews would come and live in Jerusalem. V'Teishi Yadot Be'arim, and 9/10 would stay in the cities. V'Yivarcho Amidchal Anashim Mitnadvim Le'Echad L'Shem Yerushalayim, and everybody who came to live in Jerusalem got a special blessing. So you know, you say to yourself today, wow. Not only could I be forced to go to Jerusalem, I get a special bracha, presumably the houses were given to them, you know, what unbelievable situation. And then it goes through the rest of the chapter, and I'm not going to read this through, because it tells you, and now it tells you of all the people who came to Jerusalem, they are mentioned by name. Again, every single family is designated over here as a sign of Hakaras HaTov, that they were prepared to come and live in Yerushalayim, and also as an important record for later on, you know, to keep, make sure that we know who is where and what and how. Barei Yehuda, Yeshu Ish Bachuzato, Bareihem, Yisrael HaKohen HaLeviim, and Atinim, Venei Avdei Shlomo. There were all these remnants from all different groups, including the servants of Shlomo. Yerushalayim, Yoshvu, Bnei Yehuda, Nei Binyamin, Bnei Yehuda, and then it goes through all the different groupings of the different tribes who lived in Jerusalem. And this again goes right through to the end of chapter 11, and I'm not going to go through Perek Yud Aleph, but just say to you that again, if you want to read it through, you'll see all the different names. We'll just look at the last Pasuk, Lamed Vav. U'min alavim machlokot Yehuda leBinyamin, and of the Levites there were divisions belonging to connected to Yehuda and Binyamin. Not that, in other words, in the areas of Yehuda and Binyamin. Remember that Jerusalem was originally divided between the two tribes. So the Levim would probably have some sort of area to live, which some of it would be in the area which was designated originally for Yehuda, some in the area designated for Binyamin, is the way I understand it. And again, all of this is basically saying that we are recognizing the people who are Moser Nefesh, who are giving the, put it as you would say nowadays, sticking their necks out, right, living Yerushalayim. Today, to me, these are the people living, you know, over the green line. Now again, without getting political, without getting into that discussion, the fact nowadays of people living in areas, you know, you'll say you go to Efrat, how beautiful it is, and you go to Gush Etzion, and you look in Shomron, all the Yishuvim, and go to Ariel, and all these fantastic places, the reality of it is, it's still Mesirat Nefesh to live there. It still takes a lot of, nowadays we would say simply, a lot of guts. Because, you know, the Arab population is not friendly, and every so often there's a pigua, there's an attack. And it's for us to recognize those people, the tremendous sense of strength of character that it takes to go and live there. And I think for us today, as much as it is in those days, you'll see in verse Kafchet, just as one example, V'lachatzirim b'stotam ibnei Yehuda yashu b'kiryat Arba. But they talk about Kiryat Arba, which today, again, is a very significant place, once more, for the Jews. Living in Hebron proper has always been a very, very big challenge. But living in Kiryat Arba, which is referring, here is referring to Hebron, but for us, that town just outside Hebron, which I suppose they consider part of Hebron, is again something which I think even if we disagree politically what they're doing, I think we have to recognize what incredible Mesirat Nefesh these people put in terms of the way that they conduct their lives under those circumstances. And I've got to admire them. I have to admire them. Whether I could do it myself, I don't know. My brother-in-law lives in Daniel, which is a very beautiful place also, very near to Efrat. You know, it does take a lot of commitment to live out there. And from the Sefer Nehemiah, we see not only the commitment, but we see the recognition. And it's always upon us, I think, not to be too taken in with the world media, but for us to recognize the tremendous connection to Eretz Yisrael that these groups represent. And that's something which I wanted to stress. Also, Bezrat Hashem, next week we'll look at chapter 12, which again is a very big list of names. We'll find out what that is all about. And we'll start dipping in a little bit into the last chapter, which, as I said, on the last week, so we've got another 2 weeks to go, we'll learn the Perek and also talk a little bit about how Nehemiah saved Shavuos. Sounds like a name of a book which our school should be publishing. How Nehemiah saved Shavuos. Wonderful title. So to be continued, everybody. Thank you so much.